from the Sky News Centre at 6. Donald Trump says there's no place for political violence as a man's arrested over a mail bombing campaign. The suspect in his 50s has been detained in Florida after 12 packages were sent to critics of the US president. The recipients included Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. After being criticised for blaming the media, Mr. Trump has struck a different tone.
The bottom line is that Americans must unify. And we must show the world that we are united together in peace and love and harmony as fellow American citizens.
Two takeaway bosses in Lancashire have been found guilty of the manslaughter of a teenage girl with a nut allergy. The pair of the Royal Spice in Ozzel Twizzle were found to be negligent for Megan Lee's death in December 2016. The 15-year-old suffered an allergic reaction after eating a kebab. Our reporter Fraser Maud has more from Manchester Crown Court.
She took a couple of bites of the kebab and began to have the beginnings of an allergic reaction. She took Pyrotin, felt much better a short time later and continued to eat the rest of her meal. She left the kebab, but then it was when she returned home later that she then went into full anaphylactic shock, collapsed and had intense difficulty breathing.
Turkey wants to extradite 18 suspects from Saudi Arabia after the killing of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The Istanbul prosecutor's office has prepared a request. The GMB union says reports of almost 2,500 potential job cuts at Asda is a hammer blow to staff. The supermarkets refused to confirm the details. Scottish Conservative leader Ruth Davidson has given birth to a baby boy. She says she and her partner Jen Wilson are delighted by this morning's safe arrival at Edinburgh Royal Infirmary. And a French urban climber has been banned from climbing any building in Britain after scaling one of the London's tallest skyscrapers without ropes and without permission. Alan Robert got to the top of the 202-metre Heron Tower yesterday, causing road closures. That's the latest. I'm Victoria Lawrence.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Let's go!
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us haunt our way through this week's news is former Bradley Stoke councillor. Now he's on the UKIP National Executive, Ben Walker. Also former squatter, Rick Carey. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 7 o'clock news, yes, we look at this week's dubious terror outrage in the United States. Then some real right-wing terrorism in Brazil as Jair Bolsonaro, who harkens back to the good old days of Brazil's fascist dictators, looks to be elected president on Sunday. First, Bolsonaro will relax the gun laws. Then he aims to dismantle the Brazilian state because he says it's inherently less corrupt than the private sector. When he gets in, the champagne corks will be popping at Southcom. Who are they? Well, they're the Americans that control Brazil. Also, what is the INF Treaty on Land-Based Nuclear Forces? Why is Trump pulling out? More importantly, what does it mean for us here in Europe if the Trump regime decides to send the special forces in to instigate regime change in Moscow, like they did in Iraq and Libya and tried to do at Damascus? That Cold War agreement saw thousands of missiles with ranges between 300 and 3,400 miles range destroyed and further development of those missiles banned. But Trump's throwing that agreement out the window. And an international criminal court lawyer from The Hague says he believes they'd rather poison defendants to death than allow them to be acquitted. What kind of justice is that? So Martin Summers has his chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after seven. First, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Lows of 3 degrees Celsius tonight, and mainly dry this weekend. Highs, if you can call it high, 9. Sunny intervals and a moderate breeze. Next week, highs of 11. Sunny spells, a few showers though next week, and pretty breezy. Next weekend, that's the 3rd and 4th of November, highs of 11 Celsius, sunny spells and showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is former Bradley Stoke councillor. He's now on the UKIP National Executive, Ben Walker. Hi, Ben. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi. Thanks, Tony.
Now, you've just been recording with the BBC. Are you allowed to say anything about what you were talking?
I don't actually know if I am allowed to say if it's pre-recorded.
Yes,
but
you
it
are.
Is, but it is.
Anyway, so what have you been doing? Are you going to be on... That'll be broadcast on Sunday.
Yeah.
But what's your take home from what you've been chatting about?
Oh, well, the crux of the show this week was food banks, obviously an important issue, and Brexit, which is kind of why.
Well, that's why they got you there. Yes.
So what's
happened to UKIP? They seem to have mostly disappeared off the screens, even though everything's getting very tense with what's really whether there's actually even going to be an agreement or not. So what's your take on where we stand at the moment?
Where we stand or where UKIP stands?
Well, we stand as a country. I mean, what's UKIP's take on how Theresa May has managed to do or not do the deal?
To be honest, I think UKIP's take is probably pretty similar to everybody else's, your man on the street or whatever. I mean, people are just sick and tired of Brexit now, and the whole round of negotiations are just such a mess, and I think people are wondering, what is going on here? Why isn't this sorted out?
Martin Summers, I know you're not a great fan of Brexit. Do you think it was always supposed to be a mess? Is that because we haven't played our cards right, or because we just voted the wrong way in the first place?
Well, it was always going to be more complicated than people thought, and it's no point getting bored of Brexit because we're going to have to put it with the rest of our lives.
Well,
so
on the City Council...
there's no point getting bored of it. It's going to go on forever.
On the City Council, Paul Smith said, quite rightly, it's always easier to get married than to get divorced, isn't it? But what's your thoughts, though, Ben, on the deal that we're looking at now, which is the... it looks as if there will be some sort of extended intermediary period where we will be half in and half out of the EU, that we won't be leaving next year as we thought we might be.
I think for me, it's really frustrating when you look if you look at local authorities, for instance, who are struggling to make ends meet and are cutting back services now at a rate which is just phenomenal, yet we are still blindly happily going to give $39 billion to the EU as a divorce payment, and if it does get extended like you say, we're looking at another $15 billion. Ridiculous amounts of money when, you know, this money could be redirected to actually the people that actually need it.
What would you do, though? It's easy to criticise, isn't it? And there's lots of people
criticising.
What would you do if you were in their shoes?
Ultimately,
what deal would you be doing now?
I want a deal. And I think the big frustration for me is the fact that we're not really, or it doesn't seem that we're any closer to having one. I would like a deal. You know, we're not going to stop trading with the EU. That just isn't going to happen. But we need something, and businesses need to see something so they can start to plan and sort of, you know, make a way forward. So I'd want to see a deal. What that deal is... Who knows? But for me, I mean, if we're going to sort of stay in the status quo of kind of what we are, this checkers business and all that now, I'd rather leave with no deal.
Martin?
Well, I think that's a view. I don't think it's a majority view in this country. I think that in actual fact, but when we said, by a margin that we wanted to leave the EU, it wasn't clear what that meant. Norway's in the EU, but in the single market. So many, both Aaron Banks and Nigel Farage said, those who say we will have to leave the single market, if you vote to leave the EU, are scaremongering. So lots of people voted to leave the EU under the assumption that we wouldn't have to leave the single market.
So we got it wrong.
That wasn't the case.
We were just stupid in our vote. We need to do it all again.
No. And you can, don't forget, you can have votes again and again. You don't actually... The idea that we have a vote once and that's the end of it, it's only the end of it if we think it's the end of it. In Britain, the constitution is that the Queen in Parliament is sovereign. Referendums are only advisory.
So the Queen can ignore it if she wants, can she?
Well, anybody, if Parliament decides to hold another referendum, that's what will happen. And of course, what will happen is, I don't think a deal's possible given the it's a snooker situation. So in that situation, the likelihood is that the Parliament will call an election because the majority will fall. The current majority will fall. If Sinn Féin turned up, they'd already be out. But of course, they don't take their seats. It's not clear that they've got a mandate to negotiate. And at that point, there'll have to be a general election.
Well, last week on the BBC World Service, Adam Fleming is their Brussels correspondent. I thought did quite a good job at trying to sum up the various different options at this stage which are on the table.
talk about scenarios, I think I've written down about six different ones that range from the original plan working, that you get the UK to sign the backstop, and then the future relationship documents really rosy and optimistic to help the backstop and the withdrawal agreement get through Westminster. Do you have the UK just biting the bullet and joining a full-on customs union? Does Theresa May extend Article 50, which would be possible under the treaties if all the other leaders agreed? Do you get her to ask for a new mandate from Michel Barnier? Do you join the EEA, or do you walk away and have no deal?
Oh, okay, back to me. So, you know, what he's saying is absolutely right, but I think what needs to happen is there has to be an element now of political will, and I don't believe that there is any. And you know what? I'm not only just criticising the government on that front. I think from all parties, there's too much sort of point scoring. There's people just trying to use it as an opportunity to get one over on their opposition. And I actually think that we should come together now, and instead of trying to do Brexit down, let's try and make it work and make it happen.
Now, Tommy Robinson has got a lot of supporters. He's nearly in Brexit. Nearly in UKIP, isn't he? He's doing everything he can to become part of what you do. Surely, with all that support, you've got to finally say, and also with the difficulties he's had through the courts and things like that, he's become a bit of a hero, hasn't he?
Do you know what? I'm absolutely the wrong person to ask on this, because I don't have... Whilst I agree with some of the things that Tommy Robinson talks about, I don't support his campaigns. I don't recognise the anti-Islam cause that he bats for. I find it very hard to agree with much of how he stands.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, and I think the problem for, you know, mainstream right-of-centre formations like UKIP is, what do you do with people like Tommy Robinson who want to join the bandwagon? And I'm perfectly happy to hear you say that you don't identify with what he stands for. But inevitably, he represents a strand of opinion, just like the loyalist paramilitaries represent a strand of opinion. And we don't really have a functional political system, because as you'll know before, coming on the show before, Ben, if we had PR, all of these different factions and groups would be there to be molded around. But
In the Daily Mail this week, the EDL founder Tommy Robinson went straight from court, it says, to lunch with UKIP top brass at the House of Lords after being told he faces a wait to learn if he will be jailed for contempt. So what, maybe you first, Martin Summers, what is Tommy trying to do here, and is there any justification to his cause?
Well, no, there isn't really. I mean, I remember when he first appeared, that both the English Defence League and Al-Majid Haroon appeared like mushrooms after a march by the Royal Anglian Regiment through Luton. And when he was first in the media eye, he said, "I knew nothing at all about Islam, and then I started looking on the internet, and then I found out all this stuff." And I thought, well, you still know nothing about it after all these years. But he's made a career out of being a stirrer, if you like. And, you know, others on the left make similar careers. The question is, I mean, I think for UKIP, it's poison, to be honest with you. If you draw him into your party, you will be hammered, basically, by all centrist politicians. So it's actually suicide for you to go down that road.
Isn't it a bit like the Front National embracing some of the Pétainists and, the far right in France?
Well, it's always a problem. I mean, they've got a first-past-the-post system in France as well, which forces this kind of thing. Although, of course, they have two rounds in the presidential and local elections, so you can vote for what you really want in the first round, and then you've got to vote against what you don't want in the second round. But it still leads to this kind of, you know, people who are not really bedfellows being forced to be bedfellows. But if you've got PR, then Tommy Robinson can stand in elections and see if he can get anybody elected.
Yeah, but we don't.
And the fact is, he probably wouldn't get many people elected because his support is very wide, but it's very, very shallow.
So, Ben, there is Tommy drinking red and white wine with UKIP's Lord Pearson and their leader, your leader, Gerard Batten.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, when you first asked this, I have a real issue with all of this. You know, when I joined UKIP, it was because, and the Constitution says so, it's a libertarian party. I am at heart a libertarian. I believe in a small state, and I believe in low taxes and people to sort of, you know, make their own way and make their own opportunities. And that's what I believe in. This whole move towards...
So it sounds to me like you're not going to be attending Tommy Robinson's world tour that he's planning, apparently.
Unfortunately not. I haven't booked up for that, no. But...
You know, like I said, I understand some of the concerns that the guy has, but I would much rather work with people like Sammy Woodhouse, who is an actual survivor of the atrocities that went on in Rochdale. But she doesn't just shout from the rooftops about how bad Islam is. What she comes up with is solutions, ideas on how to move forward. You know, Tommy is someone who is exploiting opportunities. I mean, if you look at the whole I Stand With Soldier X, this new campaign that he's run, I mean, that's absolutely ridiculous. He has exploited young lads at a service station in basic training and has used them to launch this new campaign. He doesn't really care too much about the young lad who got discharged. He doesn't really care too much. He is an opportunist. And whilst I don't have much against people who take opportunities, I do when you're using people as pawns. And, you know, I don't like the rhetoric that's used. And I worry about UKIP. And it's a lot to do with the failed leadership over the last few years. But this loss of direction, and now there is a train of thought that thinks, well, maybe to become a populist party again, we need to tag on to these sorts of campaigns. And I just don't believe that that's the right way to do it.
Well, more power to your elbow. And also, we've had this week, I suppose, I mean, you've just been talking about food banks and things. At Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday, austerity came up, whether Theresa May really has given up on austerity. We'll find out, maybe, in the budget next week. Martin Summers, what's your guess? Do you think we'll have an end to austerity in next week's budget?
Well, the problem is that we should never have had austerity in the first place, to be honest with you.
Come on, let's just have your guess about
that. Well, will happen is that don't forget, we've already had tax cuts for the wealthy. At that point, you've already decided that the deficit doesn't matter. It does, but by giving tax cuts to the wealthy, then everybody else says, well, hang on a minute, if you're going to give tax cuts to the wealthy, what about all the money we need for local authorities, etc., etc., etc.? The DUP have just got a £1 billion bung to prop the government up. So the money's there. The question is, how are we going to distribute it? But, of course, that's not the real problem. The real problem is that the banking system is as shot to pieces as it was 10 years ago, and nobody's talking about that.
One of the problems is the lack of nurses. This is a basic thing in any society.
Mr. Speaker, applications for nurse training dropped by 12% in September. That's the reality of taking away the nurse bursary. Yeah. Those that want to become nurses cannot afford to go into debt in order to do a job they want to do and we all need them to do. Yeah. Mr. Speaker, this government is simply not being straight with the public. They promised an end to austerity. They can't even fool their own councillors. They promised the NHS an extra £20 billion. Don't know where it's coming from or when it's coming. GP numbers falling, health visitor numbers falling, and nurse numbers falling also. They promised universal credit would protect everyone. The work and pension secretary let the cat out of the bag. People will be worse off. The Prime Minister claimed she's ending austerity. So will she confirm that in next week's budget there will be more police on our streets, more nurses in our hospital, and elderly people in desperate need of care will not go ignored and forgotten by her government?
Prime Minister!
Right Honourable Gentleman. What have we seen under this government? We've seen more money being available to the police. We've seen more money for the health service, more money for social care, more money going into local authorities, more money going into our schools. And at the end of this Parliament, we'll be spending £500 million more in real terms on people of working age and children in our welfare system. But let's actually look at what we now know about what the Labour Party's alternative is. Because we now see, as reported by a respected academic, that by their own admission, Labour's plans would cost £1,000 billion.
Wow.
That's the equivalent of £35,000 for every household in this country. We know what that would mean. Higher debt, higher taxes, fewer jobs. Labour just taking us back to square one.
Well, obviously, I tend to agree with Jeremy Corbyn rather than the Prime Minister there. I think the problem with this is that people think that because they've had a hard time with austerity, that that must have solved the problem and it's time now for a few goodies. In actual fact, the fundamental problems with the banking system and zero interest rates and quantitative easing, which has been going on all over the world, not just in Britain, are coming to a head as we speak. The question is the global stock market going to collapse before Christmas? And of course, if it does, we won't be arguing about this anymore. We'll be arguing about in a much different context. And the idea that if you just bandy figures about like 100 billion and it's going to cost this, it's going to cost that, most people don't understand those figures. And it doesn't really matter whether they understand them or not. What really matters is what your will is and what your direction of travel is. We used to have top rate of tax in this country of 95% during the Korean War, so we could fight the Battle of the Injin River and we could also have a National Health Service. Are we going to go back there? That's how it used to be.
Well, King Mervyn, I called him. He was saying that the austerity program in 2010, roughly, he said this, it's having the same effect as if we were fighting a world war.
Well, the problems we're facing are on a global scale and could be compared to a world war, and we haven't even got to the geopolitical bit of the show yet. I think the problem is that everybody thinks the economy's fixed, and we're now arguing about, you know, how to distribute the money that's been agreed to be distributed. But in fact, I think that that's a bit of a delusion. And of course, politicians in the mainstream don't want to tell people the truth, which is it's not fixed.
Well, Theresa
and nobody
May
really knows how to fix it.
There was talking about all that extra money going to the police.
It commends.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. West Yorkshire Police has 900 fewer officers than it did 8 years ago, the result of a 45% rise in violent and sexual crimes in my constituency this year. And now the Association of Police and Crime Commissioners have warned that the government's pension shortfall will cost £165 million and leave 4,000 fewer officers on our streets. In West Yorkshire alone, this means another 400 officers lost. Does the Prime Minister agree with me that this is a national scandal and that the police should be fighting crime and not fighting for funding?
Prime Minister!
I say to the Honourable Lady that, of course, we have seen an increase in, particularly she referenced the issue around sexual abuse crimes and crimes of that sort. We have seen an increase in the number of crimes being reported. That is partly because we've now got an atmosphere where people are more willing and ready to come forward and report these crimes. She refers to the issue of the pensions. This is an issue that has been known for some years.
That was her answer. What do you got to say about that,
Yeah,
Ben?
You know what? I'm not so sure that people do feel like reporting crimes as much as the government thinks that they do. A lot of people just don't bother because they think that there's going to be no end goal. The police aren't going to be interested. And we've seen that in recent stories. You know, the police, they're not really too interested in burglaries now, and they're more interested in crimes that are online, on Twitter, when you've said something quite vile to somebody. The whole policing issue for me is an absolute mess. And I don't think they understand what they should be policing against.
We've got a bit of a sensationalist headline in yesterday's Bristol Post, Blood on the Streets. But the central point here is fairly important, which is a massive increase in violent crime. Martin, what do you put that down to?
Well, I was the first I've heard of this. I mean, it is partly reporting of crime, but crime doesn't go away. It's a part of the furniture. It's been going on forever. And the police are pretty clear that they haven't got the resources they need to deal with the job. Now, you can say, well, they're just belly aching, but I tend to feel that they're not belly aching. And when they say they haven't got the resources, they're genuine in saying so. And we've lost police officers. It's quite clear in Avon and Somerset, we've lost hundreds of officers. That's bound to have an impact on your effectiveness, isn't it?
Now, we're also joined in the studio by Rick Carey. Thanks for being patient sitting there, Rick. You are actually in the same edition of this paper yesterday. I think it's you. Is about whether or not the City Council are being... In fact, there's any sense to their programme. Here we go. Former squatter, and this is you they're talking about, we helped to make the site safer. So can you just tell us whereabouts this is and, you know, what's the story here?
This is a property on Redcliffe Wharf, one that's been stalled in development for quite a long time. The contract was signed under George Ferguson's reign, and nothing has happened since. There's been some back and forth about the affordable housing provision there. I believe there's
Lots and lots of houses there, aren't there? There's actually loads of development further down towards the suspension bridge. But is this a little bit closer to, say, Queen Square area we're talking about?
Yeah, it's Queen Square. It's right next to the hole in the wall. It's right next to St Mary Redcliffe's. It's actually listed under its Grade 1 listed area. We occupied the building in 2016, equipped it with a 12-volt solar rig, central heating system, working off a back burner, and we kept the area safe. We kept people homed, and we would always observe what was going on. There was a drop in antisocial behaviour whilst we were there. Unfortunately, earlier on this year in March, the council finally worked out that we were there, which shows they weren't checking the property at all. They sent us an eviction court date. I emailed Colin Moulton, who earns £1,500 a day, who has been, I believe he's the executive director of housing or something similar, some kind of made-up job that allows him to retain so much salary, and Joe Jeffrey, who's one of his employees at the council. Colin Moulton was the chap that was involved with the arena, and he seems to be getting pushed to all kinds of development areas at the moment. Emailed him saying that because we had installed fire alarms, fire extinguishers, we were constantly running fire safety workshops, we felt that the building was safer with us until development, and that we should be allowed to stay as a trespass with consent. They disagreed. We were kicked out.
There's actually quite a lot of landlords who would say, well, fair enough, you know, we're not going to be doing anything for the year. You can stay there with a licence. I mean, a licence is quite a normal thing to have with a landlord, isn't it?
Yeah.
If that landlord is a reasonable person.
It's unfortunately something that we see a lot less of nowadays. I do know the council have an agreement with, I believe it was half of the Site A lot that we're protecting the carriage works, and have offered them a trespass with consent site, which I won't mention where it is because they don't want any visitors. There's various cases where the council have offered a trespass with consent or a property guardian scheme, although they have recently stopped working with Camelot as they were undertaking some illegal evictions. But our argument was that the building was safer with us than anyone else.
Well, that sounds very sensible. Do you know what was originally used for and why the council vacated it?
So it's been a derelict building for many, many years. I spent about 6 months and was ill 3 times, cleaning out all the pigeon poop, boarding up all the areas where the pigeons were getting in, bleaching the floors, put a lot of work into the building to home 8 people there.
How long were they housed for?
So they were housed from November 2016 to March 2018, so
that's over 18 months anyway. It's pretty good, you know,
for quicker at maths than me. So we were given marching orders. Luckily, everyone was able to get homed either through our various networks or through private lets and things like that. We had to scramble to get everyone sorted out.
So the latest is the place has had a rather nasty fire.
Yeah, very convenient that it's all Grade 1 listed and all the timber inside is burnt now, which is me with my tinfoil hat on. Once we left the door...
So, hang on, what you're implying there is that, well, hang on a minute, this is actually quite convenient for anyone that wants to develop that site, because it means that they no longer have a listed building which they need all sorts of difficult consents to develop.
That's right. As soon as we were out, the door was ripped off. There was a group of rough sleepers that made their way inside there. They were drug users, which, you know, if you're on the streets, I need a drink on a Friday anyway, let alone someone that's dealing with being on the streets. But they had habits, possibly not the right people to organise and keep it safe. They were in there for a good couple of months. I had a chat with contractors down there. They said that they constantly secured it, but it constantly got opened again because there was no council security there. It's lucky that no one died, really, because the council did have a duty of care on that building. So if someone had died in that fire, it would be all up to Colin Moulton to explain exactly why he didn't have someone in there securing it.
How would you characterise the council's attitude to these empty properties, which it does seem as if there are people like you around who are prepared to actually make sure that they don't catch fire like this has, and we lose a listed building?
I think any business, organisation or individual probably around the country will say that dealing with the local government authority is often not the easiest thing to do. Hence why we have a political infrastructure that can advise and almost back-channel these kind of things to make arrangements, to deal with the PR, to make sure it's spun in the media in a correct way and that people are safe. Bristol City Council, with Bristol having a history of a culture of doing things a little tiny bit differently, an alternative place, it seems to have stepped away from that, and it seems to be moving way more towards a more authoritarian kind of setup, instead of a council that takes our tax to manage things on our behalf as a governing body. We see the council more and more acting as if it's a private business that isn't in any way accountable to us, and it's a real shame, because it's a beautiful building, massive timber beams. You don't see big timber beams carved out of trees anymore. It's all steel beamed. It was great. The architecture was amazing. It's a beautiful place, and it's a shame that we couldn't have kept it safe for a bit longer.
So if you thought, you're not going to bother looking after a building and helping people get housed again?
No, I've just come today from doing a bit of carpentry and a bit of electrics on another place. One of the things I like to do is, my ideology is to do things for free and to kind of help support people. So I spend most of my times in derelicts doing them up so people can live in them.
Well, Rick, I'll tell you what, I was going to say thanks very much but I'll let you have a listen, and we're going to have a listen now to Marvin Rees, the mayor, who I'm sure would totally disagree with what you've just said, characterise the council as authoritarian. I think he sees himself more as a libertarian, but I will get your comments after we've heard from Bristol's mayor, Marvin Rees. He won't come on this show, he says he's too busy, even though the last time we asked him on, he'd agreed to come, and then he turned us down at the last minute. He was actually sitting outside the door here waiting for a meeting and still wouldn't come in. So let's have a listen to Marvin Rees's State of the City speech. This is from last week, and I think because we can't get him on the radio, he won't come on. The best thing to do, I think, over the next few weeks is just play some excerpts from the speech, so at least we can see where Marvin is coming from. So let's have a listen to the latest extract from that now.
Now, to appreciate the significance of these findings, I must remind you of where we were just 2 years ago.
And Marvin here is talking about a survey which was done by the Local Government Association on Bristol City Council, saying how wonderful it is.
Delivery. We were taking charge under a government committed to austerity, and Brexit was on the march. I was, however, hopeful and committed to delivering the fresh approach the city needed. I mean, after all, why stand for election unless you know you can bring improvement? But no one could have anticipated the organisational dysfunction we were inheriting. The scale of the challenge was set out in the review we commissioned into the council governance and finance after we'd found a £30 million hole in the budget. We commissioned an expert and objective assessment of exactly what was going on. The report, titled An Independent Report on Our Financial Deficit in 2016, a very catchy title, I know, was written by Steve Bundred, former chief exec of the National Audit Office. It was published in February 2017 and subsequently became known simply as Bundred. So let me briefly share with you some of his comments. First, an entire annual budget, 2016-17, approved on the basis of a false assumption that previously agreed cuts had been fully carried out and savings delivered, and an assumption that a balanced outturn would probably be achieved, can at best be described as artful. He said there was a tacit understanding among the senior leadership team that contentious decisions should not be asked of politicians before the May elections of 2016. He said, even those senior officers who have raised concerns with me appear to have very little awareness of what a first-class local authority looks like.
Yeah, so that's a bit awkward that he's stating that he can't set a no-cuts budget whilst also discovering a no-cuts budget. It's almost like he couldn't have done the same thing. And
Marvin would say that what has happened is he's inherited a very difficult situation. He's had to cut much more than otherwise because of the lack of cuts by George Ferguson.
Yeah, he's basically saying the last mayor didn't implement cuts, so I'm going to implement cuts. It's a very weak position to be in. All the while, they're following the textbook neoliberal bible of generate growth by creating traders and various different shops, etc. I mean, there's something going on right now at the Bear Pit where the deputy mayor, Asher Craig, has decided that the Bear Pit should be a shopping mall, despite being...
Well, there were shops down there anyway, weren't there? There were some sort of places you can buy cups of tea and vegetables, things like that.
There were traders down there, but as everyone knows, the Bear Pit is a place where homeless people congregate, and it's a place where you can't just chuck a load of shops. If you're a responsible trader, such as the chap that owned the Chai Cycle, Paul Saville, he would give teas and coffees, sandwiches to the homeless, he'd chat to them. He never got any problems operating there. But the kind of people that they want to operate there are not people that understand the more radical side of Bristol. You need people that are able to engage with the homeless there, to include them, to offer them to it's
okay. So let's cut to the chase, Rick. What would you do about the homeless thing? Because we have the last estimate when I spoke to the housing guy on the city council, Paul Smith, 400 rough sleepers in the city centre, and we're getting into winter now. Is there any kind of silver bullet to help really sort this out?
Well, there's a recession coming as well. I mean, it's going to get worse and worse over the winter, and then next year it's all going to go downhill. So we need to be in a position now where we can offer crews of homeless people the opportunity to self-manage themselves, rather than evicting Pennywell Park self-managed encampment, rather than evicting Greenbank encampment, which also was self-managed. The place I was in, we were self-managed. We were quite happy about it, and we felt quite strong in our resolve, and we were targeted in that respect. We've noticed that alongside the evictions to self-managed homeless camps and squatted buildings, you're also seeing injunction as well. So there's definitely a political aspect to want to...
So what would you do if you were in charge?
There's plenty of buildings around. I mean, most people on the streets are kind of... I'm not going to say most. There's a good group of ex-forces, ex-tradesmen, people that can handle a drill. What we need is an empty building or two and the opportunity to make something happen, or even just to be left alone. There's no reason when we're cutting so much that you need to target low-impact camps that are actually reducing antisocial behaviour in areas. And... in terms of governance, you have politicians that are struggling through cuts. You have a group of labour resources that can be used to secure sites, that can be used to patrol sites, that can be used to litter pick. And I'm not saying that we need to build workhouses and get people working in them. I'm just saying that we should be looking to engage with homeless people, asking them what they want and what they can give us, because they're still our friends and family. They're our people. They're our parts of our society.
You know, potentially a resource there to actually restore buildings, as you were doing. And this is such a fascinating article. I look at this week in the Post. A building that was restored by homeless people and has now burnt to the ground because of the actions of the City Council evicting those people. Anyway, Rick Carey, thanks very much for joining us. What about how do people get in touch with you and get engaged with the whole sort of, I suppose, homeless action in the city?
So I'm part of a group called Bristol Housing Action Movement. We have been, not myself because I'm 27 and I missed the glory days of squatting, unfortunately, but we were as a group have been operating since the 80s, been part of various different occupations, political movements, bits and pieces like that. If you want to get in touch with us, we have meetings every 8 o'clock at Hydra Bookstore. Everyone's welcome to
on
come
Monday.
Down.
Mondays. Monday, yeah.
Yep. And if you want to, might have to play this back, but our number is 078-331-00399.
Just read the number once more, would you?
Yeah.
078. Sorry, you've switched it off now.
It's coming back. 078 331 003 99. And we'd be happy to talk to anyone that's having issues with housing, anyone that's having issues with someone in their family or one of their friends is homeless, and even people that are just a bit annoyed with the political structure at the moment, with everything falling apart, and want to get back on the streets, talk to their neighbours and make things happen in a really grassroots way. We've got a political infrastructure at the moment that really isn't doing anything for anyone. We've got all this hurrah about Brexit when at the end of the day the IMF doesn't care whether we're in Europe or not. We're still going to be at the whim of bankers, and that's why we have austerity right now. So whilst things get worse, get involved, try and make things better.
Rick Carey, thanks very much for joining us.
Cheers.
I wonder what Ben Walker, you're from the UK Independence Party, what do you make of this approach to things?
I really like it. I just find it amazing that in the time in which we live, we have so much of an issue with homelessness. I mean, I'm a builder by trade, and I have my own company, and I'm ex-forces. I served in the Afghan War. And, I know of lots of ex-servicemen who are currently on the streets, and, they've kind of been institutionalised by one thing, then can't sort of cope in sort of civilian surroundings, and then end up on the streets. And it's a horrific situation to end up in, and I think that is just a brilliant approach, and I just wish that people like Marvin Rees would maybe just lend an ear for a little bit, have a listen, and see if there's anything they can do. I'm sure.
I mean, as a socialist, he's supposed to be a left wing mayor, Martin Summers. Why doesn't he?
Well, I think this council is a bureaucratic organisation with a thin veneer of democratic accountability. I think a different kind of approach by the administration to groups like that would be justified. I mean, you can see what's happened here. They've got a group that's actually organised that they could have negotiated with and done something with. They kick them out, and then the whole thing falls apart because, in actual fact, they're not actually engaging with people who could be engaged with.
Homeless people are not really in a situation where they can go and apply for jobs like everyone else can, because they need to get their housing sorted out first. What Rick is doing is he's saying, yes, we can sort them out somewhere to live. Let's get that sorted first. The council, Ben, is saying the opposite.
If you had a building like that to give people a foot up, get involved, get an address, and then work from that, I don't know. I mean, I'm no expert in the field. I mean, I do have a real problem with the way that sort of Bristol City Council's kind of managed themselves, and I've learned some things today about Marvin, I must admit. I do know he's common purpose trained, whether that makes any difference, but
Well, it wouldn't be surprising. I mean, he's basically, he's a scholarship boy. I mean, he came from the wrong side of the tracks. He was brought up in refuge, women's refuges, and so on. And he was always, I know people who've known him since when he was a little boy, and he was always very bright, and he did very well in school, and now he's ended up running the city.
Is he running the city?
Because when he's running the city, this is my fundamental problem with this whole thing. We've got elected mayors in Bristol and elsewhere, but in actual fact, the only thing they can do is carry out the central government policy of cutting everything to the bone.
Anyway,
that's all they could do.
Anyway,
that's it.
We really must talk a bit more about Brexit. Sorry, folks, because the MP Jacob Rees-Mogg also raised a question at Prime Minister's Questions this week.
Mr. Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Mr. Speaker, there have been reports today that the government is willing to agree that the European Court of Justice would be the final arbiter in most cases arising from Brexit. As this would be inconsistent with the Prime Minister's previous commitments, will she authoritatively deny it?
Prime Minister.
Can I say to the Honourable Gentleman, I haven't seen those particular reports. I see quite a few reports about claims about what is happening in relation to Brexit. I haven't seen those particular reports, but if they are as he has suggested, then they are wrong. We have been very clear in the work that we have been doing about ensuring that in the future the European Court of Justice does not have jurisdiction in the UK.
See, Ben, I thought that the European Court of Justice was one of the whole reasons we were leaving, so that we actually have our own sovereignty here, and we're not getting told what to do by the ECJ.
Well, that was my understanding. I think for me, you know, Brexit was all about sovereignty of the country. It wasn't about, you know, just controlling immigration. Yes, it was about controlling borders, but for me, it was about controlling our own destiny, and that involves not being dictated to by European courts, who we have
nothing
to do with.
What about the idea of a Canada deal or a Norway deal? Because these are, I mean, I would have thought this is a no-brainer. These are already have been agreed painstakingly with these other countries. Can't we just say to the Mr. Barnier, let's just have one of these off-the-shelf deals?
You would have thought so, and I'm a complete outsider, but the trouble is, you're right. I mean, these deals already exist with other countries. I don't understand why we've ended up in a situation where ours just seems so inconceivable it's never going to happen. I cannot get my head around this for 1 minute.
Martin Summers, why aren't we just having a simple Canada deal or a Norway deal?
Well, it's because the people like Jacob Rees-Mogg don't want a Canada deal or a Norway deal. They want to leave. They want no deal. I mean, that's pretty clear about that's what they want. I don't think that was clear to the people who voted for Brexit. I mean, most people who voted in that referendum.
But, I mean,
many people haven't really put mind to think about it either way.
The reason I'm talking about this Canada deal
put across on the paper,
and,
you know,
Norway deal is precisely because it's somewhere between what this Chequers deal is and nothing at all. It's in the middle.
Well, I mean, the fact is that we've got a work. I mean, Norway had two referendums about whether to join the EU. They were in the EU single market, and the rest of the EU said, well, why don't you join the EU? You're in the EU single market to all intents and purposes. You might as well come and discuss what the rules are going to be. And they had two referendums on it, and for various reasons, the Norwegians decided, no, we just don't want to join the club. And eventually, they were allowed to have that view. And of course, their views are taken into account when the EU sets its policies, but they don't have a seat at the top. And I suppose because they're such a small country, they wouldn't have much influence even if they did sit at the table. So in a sense, not being in the club doesn't bother them that much.
Well, there's another story, and that is that potentially Nigel Farage should be an MP, because we had a very little publicity around a court case that's going on at the moment. This is over, I think it's his South Thanet or North Thanet constituency. Why has this got so little publicity? It's a massive electoral fraud case, including some senior people in the Tory party and an MP may go to jail.
Exactly, yeah. He could end up in the nick about this. Why it has no sort of coverage whatsoever, I really don't know. I think there's a few local rags have picked up on it and stuff like that, but no national coverage.
Well,
it was
only just Michael Crick on Channel 4
Michael
News.
Michael Crick.
But yeah. Interesting that someone can be stopped from being an MP because of overspending by the Conservatives. They spent, allegedly, double the amount that they're allowed to spend, Martin Summers.
Yeah, well, I think the reason why it hasn't had much publicity is because the Conservative Party runs the country and they've got quite a lot of influence, and they can keep things under wraps if they want.
But
you know,
Britain is not alone, is it, in its scepticism about Brussels? We've got Austria, Italy, Germany. I was just having a look the other day. There's quite a nice little article I put on our show page. Euroscepticism is rising across the continent. Austria, Italy, Germany, France, Hungary, Netherlands and Poland have all got serious anti-EU movements, which in polls are saying that they're over 50% against Brussels.
You know what? You boil it down. Speak to anyone. I don't think they can argue against the idea of the EU, if you like. You know, countries working together and trading with each other. The problem is when it comes to lawmaking, rules, handing over vast sums of money that, you know, you've got no control over. I mean, I've just been on a programme with the Labour MEP for the South West, who's on the one hand talking about how bad it is that local authorities have no money, and then is quite happy that we're going to give the European Union $39 billion as a divorce payment.
But what's the point? We've already sold off most of our industries. This is an article from April 2012 in the Mail. The UK for sale. Uniquely in the world, Britain sold more than half its companies already off to foreigners.
Again, true again. But I was reading today, you know, good little stories like, for instance, Bulmers. You know, they have seen an opportunity with Brexit, and they actually want to put some of their supply sort of chain organisation in the UK, in preparation for our exit. Again, with Boeing, they want to do something in Sheffield. They've already got a plant. They want to do another one. There are people that see opportunities, and what really upsets me about Brexit is that people are actively working against it happening. I mean, let's just roll with it and let's make the best of it. And again, you know, I think I mentioned earlier, you know, it's about political will. And again, there are parallels with the local authority. We have council officers and a civil service who, in my opinion, actively work against the wishes of maybe the local electorate or the national electorate and democratically elected members.
Martin Summers, where's the Labour Party on all this?
Well, I understand the position now is that we're in, that there's a general position that we're going to be in favour of a customs union, which effectively is a soft Brexit Norway option, although there's still some grumbling about
that.
What's
the point in that? Because we'll be leaving the institutions like the Council of Europe, we'll be leaving the European Parliament, but we'll still be being decisions will still be being made by the other European institutions like the European Court of Justice, and we're still having to be paying in. So it's not really leaving, is it?
Well, what it is damage limitation. I mean, many people don't think we should be having bridges at all. I mean, nearly half the electorate and most of
Martin, it's not even that. It's not even that. Martin, it's not even damage limitation. It's saying that what we're going to do is we're just going to give up any influence that we have in Europe and actually stay part of the rest of it.
Well, you're putting your finger right on it, because it may well be, in that case, it's not worth doing at all. And it's not clear that there is a majority in the current Parliament to put through any kind of Brexit, which means there'll have to be a general election, and then we will see what the electorate votes for.
So you think the Conservatives are going to vote against it, do you?
The Conservatives will vote against the problem they've got, the fundamental problem they've got. The DUP will accept any deal as long as it's the same deal for them as the rest of the UK. Theresa May has already agreed that if there is no agreement on a customs union or whatever, that Northern Ireland will remain in the single market.
Yeah, but that's not going to happen.
Well, no, none of it's going to happen, Tony. That's not going to happen. None of the other things are going to happen. What's going to happen? The government is going to fall, and then there'll be a general election, and then the new government, which will be a coalition led by the Labour Party, will negotiate. That's what's going to happen, we'll then negotiate the deal.
Wishful thinking, Ben, what do you make of this?
I'm really worried about a general election. I mean, I think at the moment we're given this opportunity or this kind of choice where you've got one party who's really quite bad, but then the other is just slightly worse. And that's kind of what we're looking at here. There's no one who, I mean, you know, if you were just a floating voter, who the hell are you going to vote for at the moment?
Yeah, but that's actually called democracy, isn't it? We're at this stage where it's on a knife edge, this government, anyway.
DUP people
keeping Theresa May in power. Actually, you could say the DUP are running the country in many ways, dictating much to her. I mean, because they can pull the rug out from underneath at any time they feel like it. So actually, that sort of situation, surely it's actually quite a good idea to have a general election.
You know, and there's no Tory within that party who actually wants Theresa May's job. What they want her to do is to make a hash of it, whatever, make the decision, and then you'll see some phoenix rise from
about
the ashes.
Boris? Surely he wants it.
Yeah. Ask me one on sport.
Martin, what about Boris?
Well, I think the point about all of this is that we haven't got a political consensus around what we're trying to do, which is what you were talking about.
Exactly.
Now, what you could have done is you could have invited the Labour Party to come sit with the Tory Party and put up a joint negotiating position. But that's not how our politics works.
No.
That's the sort of thing that would happen in Germany, for example, but it wouldn't happen here.
Do you know what? I mean, this might sound fairly radical anyway, but as an idea from a UKIP member as well. But given that this is the biggest decision that this country is going to make, you know, I don't know, post-Second World War, there should have been some sort of war cabinet. There should have been something where people were pulled in all around the same table and said, right, guys, how are we going to make this work? How are we going to make this work for the people that have voted for it? And against, and you've always got to be mindful of the people that lose out in any vote. You have to be. But there's got to be a way forward. And I just wish, like I said earlier, that people would come together and make this work.
It was a bit of a weird way in which we entered the EEC in the first place, because of course we did have a referendum to go in, didn't we? In 1973, we were signed in to the EEC by Ted Heath. He didn't ask anybody, he just said, I think I'm going to sign us in.
Do it.
And then it took the Labour Party 2 years afterwards, in 1975, to actually have a referendum on it, which was, you know, fairly, yes, okay, well, we're in now, we may as well stay in, rather than leave in 1975. But what it is now, the Brussels, what effectively Brussels is, which is NATO's headquarters too, is actually something quite different to what we entered in the 1970s.
completely different animal. And I think, you know, that, and that's one of the problems with this kind of decision that the country's taken now. I mean, people, the EU is not now what it was then. I mean, it's trying to be some sort of super state. You've only got to look at things like PESCO. You know, no one really talks about PESCO, but what you've essentially got is the armed services and their logistics and procurement being signed up to EU regulations, of which we can do nothing about, which are being agreed outside of any Brexit deal anyway. You know, Whitehall, all the civil servants are still running with this. I saw, for instance, Question Time last night. You've got SNP and Labour MPs saying how terrible it is that contracts for shipbuilding go to other countries. That's because of the EU, you know. But no one talks about this. No one talks about PESCO.
Well, all of this talk reminds me when I was going for my interview at Oxford University in 1976. They said to me in the interview, "What do you understand by the term siege economy?" Because at that stage, the Labour left, and of course, we only just voted to stay in the EU, and the left at that time was not very keen on the EU, and they were talking about having a siege economy, basically nationalised industries. We still had a capital control, so you couldn't leave the country with more than £1,000 without government permission, and it was a very controlled setup. But lots has changed since then. We've now got the international money laundering industry based in London, the just-in-time supply chains which have been developed under the single market will all collapse if you leave. You can rebuild them, but you won't be the same supply chains. It'll be a wholly different setup. And I think that people are looking into the abyss here. And of course, underlying all of this is the banking system is shot to pieces. The European Central Bank has not got it started quantitative easing late because it's actually against its constitution to quantitatively ease, but they did anyway in the end because they had to. And as we go into the next crisis, which is not going to be a European crisis or a British crisis, it's going to be a global crisis, we'll suddenly be talking about, hang on a minute, how do we manage this rowing boat in the middle of this hurricane? And Brexit, frankly, to my mind, is basically largely a diversion from the things we should have been talking about.
Surely it's better to be managing it locally rather than leaving it all to Brussels.
Well, in theory, it's better to be managing it locally, but in practice, when the Americans decide to withdraw from the international INF treaty, which you mentioned earlier, Britain's already said, oh, we agree with that. The Germans have said they don't agree with it, so that's another thing to disagree about later on. All of these big issues, I mean, you know, like the idea of Boris Johnson deciding on war with Russia makes my blood crawl.
It's important. This is really important, you know. Important, Ben, because you're on the national executive of UK Independence Party. Yeah. Aren't we just going to become a total vassal state of the USA now?
I would really hope not. I think we're a bit better than that. But I understand Martin's point. I can see where he is coming from. But we just need somebody with a little bit of political nous just to sort of take this by the ears and deal with it now.
It sounds to me that you could accept a single market deal or something of that sort as long as it was Brexit. You want Brexit, but you're not actually that bothered with the detail. That's what I'm hearing.
Well, the single market means you're in the European
Court. But it does. But it means
anyway, I've got one more story I want to do before the end, and that is the horrific shillings lawyers being paid vast amounts of money to try and keep Philip Green's name. And anyway, let's just make sure we name him as Lord Peter Hain did yesterday in the House of Commons.
My Lords, having been contacted by
someone intimately involved in the case of a powerful businessman using non-disclosure agreements and substantial payments to conceal the truth about serious and repeated sexual harassment, racist abuse and bullying, which is compulsively continuing, I feel it's my duty under parliamentary privilege to name Philip Green as the individual in question, given that the media have been subject to an injunction preventing publication of the full details of a story which is clearly in the public interest.
Well, innocent till proved guilty, but I don't blame Peter Hain for naming him. Why not?
I do agree with that. I do agree in the principle of innocent until proven guilty. The trouble with this for me, it smacks of a two-tier legal system. If you have money, you can make things disappear. If you don't, unfortunately, you've got to roll with the punches.
Well, time for the Murdoch News at 7. Thanks to our guest, former Bradley Stoke councillor, now UKIP National Executive Committee member Ben Walker. Also, former squatter Rick Carey. Join us after the news as Martin takes us on a tour of the world's hotspots with me.
An award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.